Manscaped, our new major sponsors on the Rugby League Guru podcast, have just launched in Australia. We've gone years without using the right tools for the job. You can be one of the first to experience their life-changing products here in Australia. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code GURU20 at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use the code GURU20. Send me a message on the Instagram page or hit the link in the podcast description. Let's get those Rubik's Cubes sorted, fellas. Let's kick off the podcast.
Down the block.
Welcome back to the Rugby League Guru podcast. Today we've got part two of our interview with Brett Finch. This one kicks off in 2004 as the Roosters, you know, they've just lost the 2003 grand final against the Penrith Panthers. It's Finchie's first year at the Sydney Roosters after leaving the Canberra Raiders. And of course, 2004, they also managed to get to the grand final. They come up against Canterbury, which you heard him talk about in last week's episode, that they played them in the semi-final and they just put on their best performance ever. And it was, you know, that game between Canterbury and the Roosters, it had been coming for 2 years now. Obviously, 2002, the Bulldogs were on fire. They lost all their points because they were over the salary cap. Roosters went on to win the premiership. Then they faced each other in 2003. And then in 2004, they played on the big stage. Now, of course, this grand final, you know, it was a big rivalry between East and Canterbury, but also it was Brad Fittler's last game. And this meant a lot to Finchie. And not getting the job done, it was really heartbreaking for him. You know, he goes in depth around those feelings, and it's quite a somber affair. Very interesting to hear Finchie talk. It's very different to the normal sort of chat you hear from Brett. Then, of course, after that, you know, as we said, Brad Fittler, he leaves the building, and the Roosters are left in tatters a little bit. They're in all sorts. It wasn't a good few years there, and, you know, Finchie touches on how his relationship with Ricky Stewart changed. Obviously, two really competitive halfbacks with two extremely high standards for themselves. So when it was going good in 03 and 04, their relationship was fantastic. But it's very interesting to see how it changed over the next few years. Eventually, he leaves the Roosters, makes his way over to the Eels, and he has a very interesting time at the Eels. You know, it's a mixed squad of real young guys and really older guys, and it's a really incredible journey there. Of course, he eventually leaves at the start of 2009, essentially asked Daniel Anderson for a leave. He had nowhere to go. He was considering retirement, England, he wasn't sure. A call from Matty Johns landed him a contract down in Melbourne, and the rest is history. Part two is a classic chat, sort of talking more about the lows. You know, part one was a lot about the highs of Finchie coming to the Roosters, debut, all that sort of stuff. He goes through a lot of tough times leading up to his time in Melbourne. This is a really, really eye-opening chat with Finchie that I really enjoyed. We also have a really interesting chat about Brett Finch's best mate, Anthony Minicello. It sort of tells the Anthony Minicello story from a slightly different perspective and really makes you consider where Minicello could have ended up in his career if it wasn't for injuries. Really enjoyed that chat with Finchie. Really raw and really honest. Considering he played with Minicello at his peak and Billy Slater at his peak, you know, Brett Finch has a great perspective on the greatest fullback ever argument. Let's kick it off.
Finch takes the shot. It's got the hook.
The 2004 season, as we said, you make your Origin debut. Tell me about when you first got that phone call. I imagine must have been one of the absolute highlights of your career.
Yeah, well, again, Brett Camorley got injured on the Sunday. So we'd had the weekend off. We had a bye. So, again, I just had lunch on Sunday. We had Ryan Cross's wedding the night before. So, I was decent nudge there because we had the bye. And I got called in Sunday night, flew up to Brisbane Sunday night, and again Freddie, that was Freddie's return match. There was Fitzy, Craig Wing, Mini, you know, all these guys, you know, there's five or six Roosters. So it was like just going into a club team. So I was really comfortable with that. You know, we get beat by two to four points, I think. We get beat by 22-18. I played pretty well. But you sort of think, you know, Joe was out for the year injured with the knee. Noddy pulled his hamstring and Trent Barrett was unavailable with injury. So I'm sitting fourth or fifth down the pecking line. So I'm thinking, you know, as great as it was, that's probably, you know, I'm grateful to have it because I might not get another shot. So I was 18th man for the game three where Freddie charged down and scored, and we had a great night out. I wore me, or training the next morning with the Roosters. I still wore my Origin tracks and training. Sticky's like, fuck, he goes, you're the bloody best. He said, you're 18th man. You wasn't even playing. I knew I'd get a reaction. I still were, but I was still a bit pissed after winning the Origin series. I rocked up in the Origin tracks and waiting for a bite, and he goes, nah. So you're the only 18th man in history still wearing the Origin tracks at 24 hours after the game.
Mate, the blokes I speak to that have played Origin, they all sort of say the same thing, that they make their debut, the game kicks off, then they look up and it's halftime, and it's just on another level. How did you find that night, the game itself?
The game was at Suncorp, mate. Suncorp's always quicker. I played two Origins at Suncorp, one in Sydney, and it's Paris is so different. You know, Sydney's middle of winter, so it's quite heavy track and dewy, and which slows it down, which helps for blokes like me. But that Queensland game was so quick. You know, it's a dry track, and even just like I remember at training, my first training session, Freddie hits me with the ball. I caught 500 passes a week off Freddie, mate. It bounces off me chest. It just, everything was quicker. Training was quicker, you know. So, yeah, I adapted pretty well that week. But my third game I played up there in game two in 06, mate, we got pumped by 30 points, and it's just like you're in quicksand. There's no way back. It's like you see now some of that momentum. We had no momentum. It's like, can this game just be over? Because it's just, you're just on the back foot all day, and it goes that quick from side to side, and, you know, you see some of the sets, they're like 60-metre sets, you know what I mean? You know, it's really tough when you're under the pump and, you know, the momentum was against you.
Mate, a couple of months later, obviously the 2004 grand final rolls around and you're taking on Canterbury. You know, we said in 03 you played him in the semi, and this is the grand final that everyone had been waiting for. And, you know, you led 13-6 at halftime. You hit an absolute cracking field goal before halftime. What was the thought process at that time?
You know what? It was a split second. I went to do six all. It's about 8 minutes left or something. 30, 40 metres out. And sometimes they're your hardest kicks. If you land it too close to the try line, you're not going to get your chases down there to contest. But if it's too short, you know, they're returning the ball 20, 30 metres out. You know, so it's a hard sort of kick to get it right. And I went to actually, if you've watched the footage, I go to do a torpedo bomb. And as I catch it, it's shaped a torpedo bomb. Then for some reason, I just think, fuck it, I'll snap a field goal, you know? Because it was a really shitty game. Both teams played really poorly. It was an absolute bludger of a grand final, and a huge lead balloon in terms of the games that had, you know, over the previous years between the two clubs, a real lead balloon. So I just thought 6-6, and then just hit myself, mate, 1 point could be important. Again, I hit it real sweet. I don't know what it was about me and field goals at ANZ. I kicked about 11 there in my career. But then the very next set, Anthony Tupou makes a break and puts Mini under the post, and it's 13-6. So all of a sudden, I look like a superstar at 13-6 with the field goal. And the Roosters, we hadn't lost leading at halftime in 3 or 4 years.
Mate, I was about to say, no one ever ran that mob down when you guys were up.
It's like Melbourne Storm, mate. Halftime, I don't know, we could have started our lap of honour. Like, it's over, you know? I look back and I think some of the stinks at halftime maybe created a panic or maybe a bit negative, but we didn't play good in the second half, and it was a bludger of a game. You know, we missed opportunities. Andrew Ryan came up with a couple of huge plays. He made a tackle on Chris Walker under the post. And then I hit Nick Crocker on full time, and he's through. You know, he's got Mini coming up the inside. He's got Justin Hodges and Chris Walker on the outside. And Bobcat comes from behind and ankle taps Croc, trips him up and say, you know, there's every chance we could have scored on the belt.
Finchie, without putting salt in the wounds, that pass to Mick Crocker, that could have been the pass of your career. And Andrew Ryan just comes up with an unbelievable play there.
Bloody Bobcat, you know. But that's why he was good, because he never stopped working. That would have been on the belt. And we're down by three, so once the try scored, it would have been pandemonium. But again, it's those little efforts, you know. And we could have been in front before that, but Bobcat made a tackle on Chris Walker. Chris Texas got the ball, he's bounced back infield and straight and near the post, and he was through. And again, Bobcat's come from the inside and made a legs tackle, and he's pulled him up. A bee's dick short, you know. So I think the disappointing thing with that game is we played nowhere near our best, and I'm sure the Dogs would say the same, but like I said, it was a bludger of a game. We didn't play well, and we're in a position where 99 times out of 100 of the previous 99 times we nailed them, you know. We kick it in the corner. We don't give you the chance to breathe, where that game we just gave far too many opportunities to the Dogs, and, you know, we got punished.
Mate, I was at that grand final, and I remember after, you know, we sort of lived in the eastern suburbs, so we went to Bondi Junction to see you guys, you know, get back there. Not Rooster fans, but just to see what was going on. And I remember you guys getting off the bus, and I saw you get off the bus 12 months earlier against Penrith, and it's just a different look. It was like, they just looked so demoralised by what had happened. And in my opinion, the 2004 side was better than 03. And dare I say, I think the 04 side was better than 02. It must have been heartbreaking.
It was in 03. I know, I speak for myself, you're sort of just happy to play in your first grand final. You know, you just, but the second year, like I said, mate, we were minor premiers. That was our worst game of the season. Now you lose your second in a row for me, and it was heartbreaking. And that sort of was the end of the beginning of the end for that team. You know, Freddie retires and the cracks were appearing. You know, the club really struggled the next couple of years, 3 or 4 years, and took a while for the club to rebuild again. But we lived our life so hard and so extreme at all levels, playing, training and off-field, that it had to end eventually, you know. And I don't know if it's hindsight or sixth sense we had, but we knew it was over. Freddie was retiring. I know I didn't drink at all that for the next 48 hours, you know. I didn't even have a beer. I was just devastated. I didn't have my first beer till Tuesday lunchtime. You know, I didn't drink at Mad Monday. I was dead. And sometimes you're devastated after grand final losses, but come Monday, you just, you know, you're ripping in. But it wasn't like, it was a real somber feeling. And it was, we really feel we missed the boat. And again, we dominated that season. The Dogs had a tremendous team as well, don't get me wrong. But we were minor premiers, and for large parts of the game, we were extremely dominant against most teams. So without a doubt, that one stuck in, you know, made me sick in my guts for a long time. And the only time I had an opportunity to atone for it with the Storm was that feeling erased. But yeah, that one hurt more than Penrith, that was for sure.
I've said it a few times on here. In my opinion, it's the 2001 Eels and the 2004 Roosters as the best teams to not win a premiership. I imagine in the change rooms after, especially being Freddie's last game, you know, explain to me the emotion around Freddie after that game.
I felt like I let him down, you know. I just felt if we lost, I could have scored 12 tries in the game, but it's my fault. If we lose, it's my fault. I'm the halfback. So I felt like I let him down. He's my hero. I remember saying to his mum, we had a big testimony, like not a testimony, like a tribute night for him. Jingle up on the Tuesday night. We're playing the Eels on the Sunday, the last premiership, the last game. So we need to win minor premiership. Speaking to Fred's mum, and she goes, "Promise me two things: win the grand final and win on Sunday." So I said, "I promise you that, Mrs. Fittler. We'll win on Sunday. We're all blind. We're all on the drinks Tuesday night. We're playing. We're all on the drink." I said, "We'll win on Sunday. We'll win the premiership for Freddie." And he is my hero. He still is my hero. You know, like, he's a childhood hero. I loved it. Loved the bloke. And we got the first part done on minor premiership, but to let him down on the biggest stage, and we didn't play well. If you play well and lose, you can half wear it. We played shit ass, you know. And like I said before, I didn't play well, but even if I played well, I still would have felt like it was my fault, because that's how I took games. If you didn't win, it was my fault. You know, I took the blame. So I certainly, you know, myself, I would take the blame in meetings or videos or to the general poll or to the media, and then I did. I come to me and said, "It's my fault. I feel like I cost them the game." So it's a somber dressing room, and like I said, it was a somber few days. And even the, you know, you get to a week later, you have the presentation night, you usually fire up and have some fun. It was, I had a couple of beers, did the awards, and home, you know.
Mate, obviously Brad Fittler, you know, he leaves the building at the end of 2004. 2005 rolls around. What's that?
Freddie leaves the building and the building falls apart.
Mate, was it hard to get up for 2005? I imagine, you know, you guys were training so hard those 3 years, and, you know, I would guess it's a little bit easier to train hard when you're successful, but when it's not going your way, you train even harder. And you mentioned, yeah, like quicksand before. I imagine it would have been like that.
Yeah, well, mate, we trained just as hard. We had a really good squad. Thought we're going to go again. The game was sort of changed. You've seen 2005, the Tigers won with more exchanges of passes. We're very one out. We'll try and beat the kick early. You know, the game had sort of evolved. Tim Sheens was smart with that, to beat that sort of rush defence, target the edges with short interchange of passes. Running out of gas. One thing about that Roosters team from 2000 to 2004, they made four out of the five grand finals.
Yeah,
that's amazing. But they're not spoken about as one of the great teams, because you only win one comp. But to get to that level, and I was there for the two of the years, But to get to that level, a lot of those guys played in the four grand finals in that 5-year period. It sucks the juice out of you. You know, you play until October, and then you know the boys going on kangaroo tours to November, December. You know, and eventually it gets you at the back end. And if you're burning the candle at both ends, that don't help. And mate, we really miss Freddie, because Freddie was a great buffer between the coaches and the players. You know, because Stick was quite hard, but Fred had that relationship where he goes, mate, come on, Stick, you're probably going on a bit there, or mate, go for your life. So he was a real great buffer. We didn't have that, and I know for Sticky, mate, to coach the first grade at that time, there was a lot of pressure on him.
Yeah.
Like the pressure from the top was on him. He would put it onto me. I'd put it onto the teammates, you know. And like you said, when we started losing or we weren't going so good, what was successful for us was to work hard. So guess what we're going to do? We're going to keep working hard, or we're going to work harder, you know. And I understood that. And that was the way I did things. So I was with that with Ricky. But, you know, we just – the game, that our style had to change, you know, and that our run had sort of come to an end, and we struggled there for the next 2 years.
Mate, obviously 2005, you missed the finals for the first time in ages, but I guess the one silver lining, your good mate Anthony Minicello, his football is just on another level that year.
Oh, mate, he changed the way fullbacks play. So all these fullbacks now earning $1.3 million, you think the mountain cat. Back in the early 2000s, late 90s, if you kicked – you know, down into the corner, you'd only have five or six blokes chased down that side of the field. Fullback would just run out your tackling, you know. The mountain cat, the, you know, Mini of the human pinball, he'd bounce off two blokes, he'd be on the other side of the field in no time,
yeah,
making a break. He was the first fullback with the 20 carries a game, 300 metres effort, you know. Fullbacks didn't do what he did, you know. He'd be taking hit-ups off the scrum coming out of your end and play ones and plays twos. He changed the game. And I remember... with Billy Slater, towards the end of his career, he was his 300th game or 250th or something with Bill. There was an article, and I was with Billy down in Melbourne, and he had an article on the five most influential people in his career, and it was with his mum and dad and someone else. And he had Craig Bellamy and Cameron Smith, and he had Anthony Minicello. And he wrote a piece on each one and what they meant to him. He said, Minnie, I've only met Minnie once, so he's not a mate. You know, it seems like a lovely bloke, but I don't know him well. He said, but he changed me again, because Craig Bellamy came to me with a DVD in 2005 and said, if you want to be the best, play, watch this. This is the standard. And I feel for Minnie, because Minnie won two Harry Sutherland medals, which is the kangaroo tour player, of the player of the tour. He won a golden boot, won two Wally Lewis medals, won like Daly M fullback of the year. He was the best. He was the best fullback in the game, probably the best player in the game, and not the world. And for me, which I feel sorry, his injuries took him off the top of the mountain. It's a bit like, if you're going to knock me off my throne, I want you to beat me off it. You know, not couldn't fight for his jumpers, you know, and he has a horrific run of neck and back injuries, and he doesn't get back to sort of 07, 08, 09 to fully fitness. And by that stage, Carmichael Hutt comes through, Brett Stewart, Billy was on the scene, you know, like there's all these developments of great fullback, and fullback had gone to that next level, you know, in the importance because of how many played the game. So I felt for him, being a close mate, you know, it was extremely hard to watch the sidelines, the game go. It wasn't, and he couldn't put up a fight because of the injury. So, but you're right, mate. He, during that period, he was unstoppable, mate. On and off the field. He was a single. I was living with him. I would know.
He's a good-looking rooster.
Mate, they love the mountain cat. I said, mate, we'd be leaving the nightclubs and be going, mate, how have you done this? I've been with you all night, you know. You're a genius. It helped me out being a battler. I run off the net. I'll set you up for a few tries on the field. You set me up for a few off. But he's my best mate, and I love playing with him. But he's one of those infectious blokes. He was just high energy, fun to be around. If ever you tell him a joke, you want to tell Minnie, because he'll laugh at anything. You know, he was great for my story. He just made me feel great. He's laughing. And you're right. He was off the charts that year.
Let me ask you, Brett, if those injuries didn't happen, a hypothetical, where do we sit on the argument as far as the best fullback ever, in your opinion? You know, you played with both Slater and with Minicello, obviously very different fullbacks, but as you said, Minicello was cut down at his absolute peak. Where do you think it would have finished with both of them?
Well, Minnie gets injured at the end of 05, like the off-season, start of 06. So that's the start of, like, we won three Origins before that. Minnie's not there. So Origin starts the run. Slater still would have been great, or he's one of the greats. It's a bit like Benzie has a wedding, I think, his own wedding. So he stands down from the tri-series in 2006. Smithy gets a chance, and he never plays hooker again.
Yeah.
Now, Mini was like that. Now, players still might play better than you, but those rep teams, they're harder to get out than get in. If you're still winning and playing good enough, they pick you, you know? So you never know. Like someone like Billy or these folks may never have got the opportunity at rep level that we've seen, even if they could have been as great as what they were, you know? And they were champions, but, you know, during that period, start of 2000, the 5 or 6 year period, Mini was, without doubt, I think one of the, you know, he was the best and most consistent player in the game. And he was playing Origins and Tests. You know, I think he played more games in that period, you know, about 30, 20 more games or 15 more games than the next person in the comp, you know. And, you know, he was just a rock star.
Mate, obviously that 05, 06, 07 for the Roosters, not overly flash. And obviously the years before that, when you're making grand finals, you're playing Origin, you're almost winning Dally M's, you know, you're the halfback. So you get all of the praise that comes with it. When your team's going shithouse, you wear 90% of it, and you might have been the king of wearing shit when teams weren't going well.
99. It is, mate, and that's why I love halfback. I wouldn't change anyone else. You know, there's been games you walk off field and go, well, you won because of me. You know, that's the mentality. I wanted to make a difference. Now, I went through a tough period there. I wasn't playing great footy, but, you know, it's part of the journey, and that's what makes who you are. And again, I felt like that time I learnt a lot about myself and learnt a lot about the game. And, you know, I was never the most talented player, but I was resilient as anyone, you know. Like, you're picking a player on pure skill and talent, you're not going to pick me. But if you want someone who's resilient and will do anything to win, I was your man. So, no doubt, I didn't play well during that period and the team suffered as well. But you certainly gather plenty of resiliency and, you know, the thick skin, you know. I had thick skin about myself, you know. And, you know, that helps, you know, for me back into my career.
Mate, I imagine, you know, your relationship with Ricky Stewart would have changed a lot between 2003 and 2007. I imagine 03 and 04, you have had a great time together, most of it. And then after that, when the team's yours and they're not going so well, and as you said, the pressure's mounting on him and he's feeding that down to you. You know, how did it all end with Ricky Stewart? Was there any, like, standout sprays from him you remember?
Me and Stick get on good, you know, and he had a huge part to play in my development as a player. When it was good, it was great with me and Stick. But when it went bad, it was pretty heavy at times. You know? And we're similar blokes. If he's got a problem with me, he's going to tell me. If I've got a problem with him, I'm going to tell him. You know, you're the case, but I'll tell you, I think you're not doing your job right as much as you're not. You know, like, you know, probably poor choice words for me there, but you know what I mean? If I thought, mate, we need to change that there, or you know, like we were similar characters and we both wanted the best for the team. You know, there's pressure on Stick from the board, you know, because the board expected to win. The board thought it's coming, and that's why the Roosters are a great club. The board thinks second's a failure, let alone ninth, yeah. And the pressure was on Stick, and that, you know, he rides his halfback because he's a former great halfback. And then I'd be riding the team, and when you're losing, that can become really negative. And, you know, there was a period that I was really negative and hard on the boys because I knew if you'll make a mistake, you miss a tackle, we lose the game. I'm going to go get a butt chewing from Sticky, you know. And it's at times it was quite volatile and personal, and the sledging matches or the argument to the point where, you know, you'd have to be part, you know, pushed apart, you know, like. So I got all that, but it's only because me and Sticky cared. And they, like, some other blokes in the team, they wouldn't have known, you know, we're probably two of the hardest working blokes in the club, but we're at each other because we care, and, you know, this mattered to us. We didn't like the position we were in. We didn't want to lose. See, Sticky hates losing. And that's why it's so great to be around, you know. At the end of 06, we both lived together, and I thought that was fair enough. You know, we left fine. You know, I spoke to my mum and dad later years and apologised to them. He went too hard on me. Yeah, sure, I look back, it could have been too hard, but that made me feel like, you know, like, I went after that, nothing after that that could rattle my cage, you know, like,
yeah. Bulletproof.
Skin like an African rhino now, you know, let's go. That helped me down the track. But, you know, I had some great times with Sticky, you know. He was great at bringing a team together, and you wanted to play for him, and he'd have your back, you know. Unfortunately, the last 2 years weren't great, but the first couple were two of the best years of my life.
What was the best Raz that you got from Sticky?
Oh, Sticky never, sorry, he ripped me. Oh, the best I got was off Gus. Gus sits me down once and I put a kick in the goal. Gus takes over a video session. I don't even know what he was doing there. And I put a kick in the goal And it stops about that far from dead ball line. We're playing the Sharks, actually, every Friday, it's Friday night. And Sir Soliola charges down. And, like, I'm thinking, Sir, steady up a bit here. Like, we've got him in the in goal just steady. So David Peachy picks it up. Sir's just a rookie. He just comes charging down. Wet, slippery surface. Peach just steps him. And Gus blames it on me kicking. I said, fuck, like, he's hemming me the whole session, Gus. Every time I touch the ball, he's just yelling out, amateurish, you know, in front of everyone. I'm like, oh, what's fuck going on here? Anyway, I said, come on, Gus. I said, that's not my fault, mate. That kick stopped half a metre from the in-goal. And, like, he's turned around because I was sitting behind him. Gus's head was purple. Like, it was the closest thing to purple, someone said. And he goes, listen here, you smart mouth boy. He goes, I'll have you back in Canberra quicker than I got you here. And, like, just this. And, like, you know those cartoons you see, like, you blow someone back in their suit. It's like that. And I look over at Sticky. Sticky's an arse. He sits there, like, he's giggling, you know. Like he's, but, no, it's me and Sticky. We've never got to. That was the best spray I ever got. But, yeah, no, I think I've heard some beauty. Sticky, one of the boys, did a prayer before the game. His name shall remain nameless. The player that shall remain nameless. But he went out there that they were bombing him. And he was dropping 8 million balls, bombs, and knocking them down. He's all over the shop. Coming half time, Sticky goes, Jesus Christ, so-and-so says, I don't see God helping you out there catch those balls, you know, like. It's like, mate, what's his prayer before the game got to do with it? But it's quite a big deal over the last.
Mate, obviously, after you're at the Roosters, you make the move to the Parramatta Eels. How did that come about?
Yeah, Michael Hagan went there. I'd been involved with Hagan at the Knights and the Mariners. Family friend, he wanted to get me on board. Then Johnny Morris was leaving to the Tigers, so it was a spot of 5'8". I was happy to move out of that halfback role. You know, I wanted to play 5'8", and Timmy Smith was the halfback, and Parramatta come eighth the year before, so they're a team who are only going to get better. And, you know, I really liked the way Hague's went about it, and I dealt with him before. So, and I had to probably get out of the Roosters, you know. I had a year to go on my contract, but I felt it was the right time to get out at the end of 06 and go to Parramatta with Hague's.
Obviously, mate, that Parramatta Eels squad, a lot of older heads, but, you know, a real mix of younger blokes as well. It was a real mixture of a footy side. How did you find it?
Yeah, mate, probably as good a mix in terms of what you're looking for in a team as any team I've been in my career. A couple of old hearts, their name Nath Kalis, the skipper, a real experienced, great leader. Hindy, Ian Hindmarsh, Chad Robinson. Then you had blokes like me and Piggy Riddell just under that. You know, we're the characters and we'd fire them up a bit out there, you know, have a bit of fun. And then some young blokes like Timmy Smith. But then the emergence of Hayne, Zaninu, Fleddy Mateo, and some real tradesmen like Benny Smith, Daniel Wagon, you know, but so it was a perfect mix of a team. We get beat by Melbourne the week before the grand final, and we really pushed them. They scored a late try late to beat us. I think they got away. They ended up winning by 8, but we led most of the game. It's funny, there's three teams, Manly, Parramatta, and Melbourne that year, where Manly would smash us, Melbourne would smash Manly, but we would trouble Melbourne. You know, like Manly could never trouble Melbourne, but dropped the ball over the line in round 18 down there, which and would have won us the game with a minute going, and we only just get beat in the semi. So we had a really good team. And again, it was good for me because I was playing 5'8", so you know, I was the second banana, so there was a bit of pressure off me there and just got to enjoy my footy for the first time in a few years.
Mate, the 2008 season rolls around, and of course it's the centenary of rugby league, and I think this might be my favourite Brett Finch story. They get all the players together for a photo, and you being the dickhead you are, finish this story for me.
And I'm talking to Brent Kite. I played for three clubs there, but mate, I knew more people in rugby league than anyone. You know, those things were my bread and butter. Like every player's there, all the staff. So I'm holding court. Boys would be looking over here. I'd be having a group of 50 blokes in the group. You know, just I'd been involved. That was 2008. So that was me 10th year in the game. So I'd been involved and knew a lot of people. I was talking to Kitey. Brent Kite grew up with Kitey in Canberra. We played Australian schoolboys together, went to Arundel College together. He was at Manly at this stage. Yep. And he goes, it's called over for all Polynesians to go to the ballroom to get the Polynesian photos all for the team of the century. Kitey goes, why don't you come in? I said, no. He goes, come on, come in. I said, you know what, I'll come in. So I hide behind a couple of the big boppers. I get in there, and so there's obviously there's players there or whatever, all in a big photo across this big stand, and I get in behind Mace. Mace doesn't know I'm behind him, and I'm, you know, me and Mace are childhood mates. And I said, oh, excuse me, Willie, can you just push aside a bit? And he's sort of like turns and like just to turn and go, yeah, no worries. He went, oh, yeah, no worries. And then it's like hitting him, like, just, and he just cracks up laughing. And then Jared's like, what's the laughing? The boys turn, and the cameraman's none the wiser. He's sitting there snapping away. And it just, the laughing just went along the line. If you could ever get a bloke who, not only was I not Polynesian, and I start saying I'm moldy and all this, mate, on that white, you know, in the middle of winter. My shade, my neck shade's invisible. You know, I'm pretty lucid, you know. My disgust, looks like I've been tanning under the house, sunbaking on the moon. So the boys had a laugh out of it. And more of I think the last bloke to know was the photographer. You know, he kept snapping away, and then he's obviously looked up and said, why is everyone in stitches? And he's thrown up, and here's this buck-toothed blonded fella snapping in the middle.
Mate, you're a complete and utter menace.
I've been told that. I can use youth as an excuse then. Hopefully with age I'll settle down a bit.
Mate, the next year, 2009, one of the most surreal rugby league stories in my opinion. You start the year with the Eels. I think you're 2-2 and you play your last game, and then within a few weeks you end up down at the Melbourne Storm. How did that come about?
You know, at the start of that year, how big a, like, if I had went for a drink on a Sunday and I trained Monday, I trained harder than anyone on Monday. You know, I had a bit of a reputation that liked a beer, but I trained as hard as anyone. My training sort of dropped off, and that was my edge to me as a player, is that I'd try and out-train you, you know? I was fit as a player, but I was a gut runner as well, so you might be naturally better at running, but I ain't stop until you drop, you know? Like, I'd outwork blokes. That's how I tried to get me relevance to a team, the enthusiasm, the energy, you know? I wasn't overly skillful or creative, so... When I lost a bit of that desire, I'd always been a big fish in a small pond in my teams. I'd played four games, like you said, into a three-year contract. I asked them for a release. I had no club. I hadn't spoke to any club. I just walked out. I thought I was going to retire. I already played over 200 games. At this stage, played about 210 games. I was in my 11th year, I think, and I was only 27. So, you know, it was one of those moments. I walked out. Like, I never had no problem with Daniel Anderson. Me and Ando were fine. But I knew, mate, there's no point me going to reserve grade. I was on a lot of money. I'm going to be a cancer back there because my attitude suffered. And if my attitude's not respectful, it's not going to be good for the club. You know, and I was still living in Bondi, so driving out there every day, I just lost the urge to play, you know. I had a season in 08 where some other blokes probably didn't probably have the best attitudes, which wanes on me. I'm going, I'm driving in here all this way and one's not all in, and then it affects my attitude. So I said, Ando, mate, just I want to release. He said, well, where are you going? I said, nowhere. Maybe England, maybe retired. I hadn't spoken to Melbourne, spoken to anyone. I just had enough. And I was thinking of retiring, and I get a call from Matty Johns, who was working with Storm. He rings me, bellyache then rings me. He said, would you be interested? I said, mate, yeah, sure. He goes, we need a 5-8 down here. All I had to do was catch and pass to Greg Inglis. He'd beat eight blokes and I'd get a try. So it was
tough gig.
It was a pretty good job, old GI. I couldn't get it in and out of my hands quick enough. But it was a great – and I was down in Melbourne. I love Melbourne. It was the end of my career. The year before I had to go back and play halfback was Timmy left and went to England. And I didn't want to play halfback. I wanted to step out of that main role. So to go down to Melbourne in a high-class environment. And all of a sudden it re-energized me because they don't need me. They've won three straight. They've made three straight grand finals. I'm one. Now, we'd love to have you feature. We think you can help us, but – if your attitude's not good enough, we'll just get someone else in. It's not like, so all of a sudden I'm a small fish in a big pond, and it fired me up again and got me working and got the hunger back. And I was as a player, hard working player, you know, and I was down there and I think I was good for him in a way where, you know, I was pretty good at lightening the mood at the right time, but I knew when to train hard. And I love working with Craig Bellamy. He's just the best. Leadership is unbelievable. It's off the charts. Had some great senior players down there, obviously Cameron Smith, Bill Cooper, Brett White at the time, Dallas Johnson. So it was a great club to be a part of.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Rugby League Guru podcast. That's the end of our part two interview with Brett Finch. Part three with Finchy drops next Monday, and part three is an absolute belter. We dive into his time at the Melbourne Storm and how that just, it's like it just kickstarted Finchy's career all over again. As he said at the end there, it just got his competitive juices flowing again. Melbourne didn't need him, but he wanted to make an impression there. Talks about playing alongside Billy Slater, Cooper Cronk, Cameron Smith, Greg Inglis, just a host of absolute superstars there. And of course, the first year he arrives, he departs from Parramatta around round four or round five. He gets to Melbourne, and then 6 months later, he plays Parramatta in the grand final. So just an unbelievable story there for Finchie that, you know, he's, you know, I'd love to know if there's another bloke that's left a team, another halfback that's left a team during the season, gone to another side, and then played his old team in the grand final. Incredible stuff. And Finchie, being Finchie, the celebrations after that 2009 grand final, it will blow you away. The poor bastard, he went for about a 3-week bender. It was incredible. He was all, you know, he was up on Sydney the night they won. Then he went back down to Melbourne. Then he went to Vegas. Then he just went all over the world over a couple of weeks. It was sensational. Talks about 2010 when he came back, how hungry he was to get back into footy. And then, of course, the salary cap scandal hits. Finchie's perspective and all that, very interesting. Of course, it means that he has to leave. He goes over to England for a couple of years, and then he returns to Melbourne. And hearing him talk about the end of his career once again, very interesting, his perspective, you know, when he knew it was all over and it was starting to wind down. There's a crazy story about when Bellamy puts him on for about 30 seconds at the end of the game, and then the next morning, that's all he does for his recovery session, 30 seconds. A crazy Finchie story you'll absolutely love. Can't wait to share part three with you. If you enjoyed part two and you haven't listened to part one yet, I highly advise you go back and have a listen. It's a cracking chat with a champion bloke. Keep kicking the corners, and as always, play smart footy.